If you have three accounts of Christ and his life in ministry, all saying similar things, someone might ask, why do you need three if they all cover similar things? While we cannot know the purposes of the Holy Spirit without him telling us, we do see some indications in the differences in these letters as to why we might have three, why three might have been written in the first century with similar content, and that is simply that they focused on different audiences. We saw Matthew's gospel focused on the Jewish reader. You can't miss that because the very first chapter shines the light on the fact that he has in mind people who are interested in the physical genealogy of this man named Jesus. When I say physical, it's actually through the royal line. So it's really the royal genealogy of the one that's going to be preached as the king over the kingdom of prophecy. So we have Mark, we have Luke. Now John is so different from the other three. It's a totally different approach. But now we have Mark with a lot of the same stories, same miracles, same events, though there are differences, and we'll look at some of that. Did Mark have a different audience in view? It seems the evidences will support that. Not only external evidence, that is, secular writers, but we'll be looking primarily tonight at internal evidence. The evidence seems to point to the fact that he had not just Gentile readers in view, but a certain kind of Gentile reader, and that was the Romans. Can we be absolutely sure that's what Mark had in mind? I can't, but I do think there are indications that favor that conclusion. Now, if you get ready to teach one of the Gospels, say in a class or with someone, you may get a commentary or some class book on the Gospels, and it'll say Matthew was written for the Jew and Mark for the Roman, etc. And you may just say that's a shortcut and an easy way to say that to the class. But the question is, what's the foundation of that? Is there evidence for that? And we as Bible students, and then heighten that, we as teachers need to try to be sure that what we read or hear is accurate, that there's some foundation for it. So what we're going to do tonight is look at the evidences that Mark's gospel corresponds to the idea, at least, that he had Roman readers in mind, people of Latin language in mind. And that would help to explain why you would have one gospel, Matthew, to the Jew, and another gospel focusing on the people whose empire was in force at that time, the Roman Empire. And so as the gospel spread throughout the Roman Empire, it would serve us a great purpose in having a gospel that recognized their peculiar phrases. And we'll see some of that in our study tonight. Now, when we talk about external evidence, as evidence outside the book itself, there was a writer that wrote much in the 3rd, 4th century. Now, a fellow by the name of Eusebius, he lived from 260 to 340 A.D. How accurate he is in everything he wrote, I do not know. But we do gain information about writers, what books were used, what books were revered. And Eusebius said in his writings that Peter went to Rome and preached, after which the Roman Christians wanted a copy of the gospel he preached. If that's correct, that would give a foundation to the fact that Mark would write a gospel with that favored the Roman reader. One problem with that is the New Testament never puts Peter in Rome. Now, is this through some other evidence that Eusebius had? I do not know. So it's an interesting thing, but nothing necessary to hang your hat on. But it is an interesting observation. Others who have studied some of the evidence he relied upon felt like there was foundation for that view. We're going to spend our time, however, on internal evidence that you can look right in the book. So we're going to begin, as you have your lesson here, with Semitic, which would be Jewish, or Aramaic, which was another language they used during that first century, Jewish or Aramaic terms of expression. And what we'll see is that they were translated in Mark's gospel into Greek. So we'll start right here with Mark chapter 5 and verse 41. Mark chapter 5 and verse 41. We have a question on your lesson. What does Talitha cum, or some versions, has a C-U-M-I, what does that mean? All right. Little girl, I say to you, arise. And he tells you that in verse 41. He has this statement, which translated means. So when we read Matthew and we read about Jewish customs, Jewish phrases, he didn't explain them because the Jew would understand it, like the preparation day. Therefore, you need to take care of the body because the next day is the Sabbath day. But he didn't have to explain that to the Jewish reader. And so obviously Mark has in view somebody who would not understand this Latinism, you want to call it that, or Semitic term. This term Talitha cum that's not Semitic. So he explains it for the Roman reader. Okay. I think I said that wrong, that it is a Latin term, but the average reader might not understand that term. And so he writes, so you will understand it. And he puts it this little phrase in there. So let's go back. Now, we started with 541 because I had that lesson, but we've got numerous examples throughout the book. Look back in chapter 3 and verse 17. You've got this phrase, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name, Boanerges, I think that's correct. I went and looked up the pronunciation, but it's something like that. And so he gave this name. So you say, what in the world is that name? And so he tells you here in verse 17, which means sons of thunder. That's the kind of thing we see repeatedly in Mark's gospel. You wouldn't have to explain that phrase to a Semitic person, maybe a Jewish person. But for his readers, he wanted to explain its meaning. We've already dealt with 541, so let's go to 7:11. Chapter 7, verse 11. If a man says to his father or mother, whatever I have to help you is carbon. Would you and I know what that means? The Jewish society or Aramaic might understand it. But Mark has readers in mind that he needs to explain. That means given to God. And so that was their excuse for not taking care of their mother and dad. I've given it to God. And Jesus exposes the error and hypocrisy of that. If you go to chapter 7 and verse 34. Chapter 7, verse 34. You got a verse 32, a man who was both deaf. He was deaf and spoke with difficulty. And so in verse 33, he touched his tongue. And he looked up to heaven with a deep sigh and he said to him. And so here's this word, Ephrathah, if I pronounced it correctly. But then he tells you what it means. What is Ephrathah? And so then you see that he explains, that is, be opened. And so it opened his hearing and his ability to speak. And so we have these explanations for the readers that he has in mind. Without these explanations, we'd have a hard time with Mark's gospel, wouldn't we? What does Ephrathah mean? What does this phrase, these two guys were called, Boanerges, which may relate to their very stormy character. You might remember on one occasion they said, Lord, should we call down fire from heaven to destroy these people? But be that as it may, it was a Hebrew nickname. All right, now we get down to chapter 14. Look at Mark 14. Verse 36. Now, you're not going to remember all these points, maybe, but at least next time you read the Gospel of Mark and you come across these kind of phrases, remember this may be an indication of what kind of people he had hoped would read his book, this Gospel. Mark chapter 14, 36, Jesus is praying in the garden. He said, Abba, Father. Abba had the same meaning as Father. Some think it was a more endearing term. I don't know that, and I don't think we can establish it for sure from what I've read. But it was a term. It was more Aramaic than the word father, which was Greek. So Abba, father. Some think that he was explaining the term when he put the word father. Some think that he was not explaining the term. The reason I find that interesting, so you're getting a commentary and you're going to read about this. And here are fellows who know the language. And I use those guys because I'm not a Greek scholar. So one of these guys who knows the language said this was a translation of Abba. But here's another guy who knows the Greek language said, no, it wasn't a translation. One guy says it was an explanation of it. Another guy says, no, Jesus used both words on this occasion. What that told me was something we've talked about in class time and again. While you have a good tool in knowing to be able, you can go to men who know the Greek language, you still have to test them. And one of the advantages is if you have more than one, you can test one against the other. And so if here are two men that know the language equally well, and one says it means an explanation, the other says, no, it doesn't. And one says, well, Jesus used both words. The other said, no, Mark was explaining one word. You know that it's not inherent. It's not objective. It's a subjective view of the commentator. You have to decide. It's not even important that you do. But it's a good lesson in our use of the tools that God in His providence has provided us. Commentary by men can be very helpful. But sometimes we lean on them as if they're always right because they're knowledgeable, and that simply is not the case. Chapter 15, verse 22, they brought him to the place Golgotha, which is translated, he actually tells you now, translated, place of the skull. This is what I read and find out is this is an Aramaic word, Golgotha. Hold your finger here and go to John chapter 19. In verse 17. They took Jesus, therefore, and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of the skull. Note this, which is in Hebrew, Golgotha. So we've been talking about Semitic Hebrew terms, Jewish terms. John tells you Hebrew, Golgotha. What does Golgotha mean? Place of the skull. And if you were to compare on this particular point, one of the other Gospels, it may just say the place of the skull. Like Luke, he just says the place of the skull. He doesn't use the word Golgotha. Again, you see the difference in these Gospels. Look at Matthew 15:34. Jesus is on the cross. And some of the bystanders heard it. They began saying, "Behold, he's calling for Elijah." That's verse 35. What they're talking about? Verse 34. Ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi," I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, "lama sabachthani." But note he tells you what it means, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, in this particular case, Matthew also explains its meaning, but Luke and John do not have that phrase at all. When they're describing the crucifixion, unless I missed it, they don't have the phrase at all. I'm in the Gospel of John chapter, where did I tell you? I'm in the Gospel of Mark chapter 15 and verse 34. Isn't it there on your lesson? 15:34? What?
It's on the lesson as that, but when you told us where to go, you said Matthew.
Did I?
Yes, sir.
That's the test if you're listening. And my test works. See, I see y'all are listening. Well, good. Has nothing to do with age or memory. Just okay, good. Thank you, Keith. I guess. All right, so sometimes, like I've noted here on your lesson, two of these, 15:22 and 15:34, are paralleled in Matthew and also translated in Matthew. But those are some Latin terms, Semitic terms, Hebrew terms that are translated in the Gospel of Mark. For the Roman reader, that would be very helpful if that's what it was. Like Matthew and Mark also explains Jewish customs. Now, I've got these on your lesson, but we're not going to look at them tonight, and here's why. We just covered these very comparisons in our last lesson when we studied the Gospel of Matthew. So if you're interested in these, I got three questions there. You can go back and look at your other lesson and your answers on those lessons. And you will see that they are, when you look at those, you'll see that there are explanations of these Jewish customs, like unwashed hands. What's the idea of have to wash your hands when you eat? And he'll explain. And then the first day of unleavened bread when the Passover lamb was sacrificed. The preparation day, the day before the Passover. So if you were here in the classes, you may remember that. But look at our next section, Latinism. So we looked at Semitic terms, Hebrew terms. Here's Latinism. Words, phrases that are maybe peculiar to a language. We have that with our United States language. We have it with Texas language, with the South. We have certain phrases that maybe people in the North say, "What in the world are you talking about?" And so they had Latinisms. So let's look at some of these. Look down at Mark 6:27. Now, if these are correct, and again, I have to depend on people who know not only the Greek language, but were familiar with the Latin language. But again, when you compare that with various men who know both, you see the same thing. In Mark chapter 6 and verse 27 in the New American Standard Version, it says, "Immediately the king sent an executioner." That's the way this version translates it. Is anybody having a version that translates it differently? Executioner is pretty much the way that that word is translated. Actually, the word is from, in the text, is a Latin word that's spectator. That's the idea of the word, spectator. But he didn't just come to look. He had him executed, took his head off. And so, that Latin term was used to indicate an executioner. So if they'd have translated it, and you could, if you know what literation is, where you take the Greek word and put an English letter for each Greek letter, it almost looks like the word spectator. But it's not just a spectator, it's an executioner. And so our translations have helped us on that by putting the word executioner and telling us what it means. But he actually used this Latin term, but they would know what that means. They use the word to talk about an executioner. We don't use the word spectator that way. And so the translations in this case have not translated real literally. They've translated the meaning as it was used by them and means that to us as well. Look at Mark chapter 7 and verse 4. Mark chapter 7 verse 4. They came from the marketplace. They do not eat unless they cleanse themselves. And there are many other things they have received in order to observe, such as the washing of pots and pitchers. P-I-T-C-H-E-R-S. This is, again, a Latinism. The word actually, I can spell it for you, won't mean anything to you. S-E-X-T-A-R-I-U-S, if you put it in English letters. So what is that? It was actually a Roman measure, a certain amount of measure. What are you talking about, washing amount of measure? That wouldn't make any sense to us. To the Roman, they knew what they were talking about. But the English reader, so they translate it, pitchers. And so you may not see the Latinism when you read the English version, but it's there in the manuscripts that we have of Mark's gospel, pointing to something that Roman readers would understand very well. Latin word. All right, look at Mark 12:42. Mark 12:42. So if Mark's writing a Hebrew word, he might have an explanation. If he's writing a Roman word, a Latin word, he might not explain it because he knew his readers would understand it. But when our translators are translating, they're not translating for Romans. They're translating for people generally, English-speaking people. So they will translate the meaning just like they do with the Greek words. Okay, so here in Mark 12:42, this is an interesting one, I think. This is the story of Jesus sitting at the treasury and watching people giving. And a poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which amount to a cent. If you have a New American Standard version, you'll see footnotes, two footnotes in that verse. And the first one, it has the Greek word lepta. Doesn't that help you a lot? And then the second one, it has another word, but if you're reading the New King James Version, it actually translates it with that word that's in the footnote of number two footnote, quadrants. And so that's a good thing to do when you compare versions. But actually, our version, small copper coins, it's one word. And the word means small, very small amount of money. If you have the King James Version, it really may throw you for a loop. You might think, boy, this money was dirty. Because it says small what, Sally?
It says carbon.
Carbon? No. That's at the end of the verse. It uses the word mites, M-I-T-E-S. Now, what do you think of when you think of mites? Something in your bed? But historically, it was a word that was used of a very small amount of money. We don't use it that way today. So the King James Version, translated when originally, 1611, now 1779. Back then, the people might have understood the idea of mites being a reference to money. But your later versions don't use that word. And so here, this version have chosen to translate that one word with three words, small copper coins, Well, who cares? It's helpful to us. All I'm pointing out is that if we see what Mark wrote, we can see that there were words that were Latin, that a Latin reader would understand. Further supporting the idea in the text that Mark had these kind of readers in mind. By the way, this is a good point to compare versions. And look up the meaning of words. If you go look up the meaning of might, if you read in the King James Version, you'll see the way we use it today, but you'll see another little note in the definition that says, historically, here's what it meant. Say, oh yeah, that fits the text. And so when you use a dictionary, don't just pay attention to the definitions, because they're going to choose the definitions that are primarily in use today to be there, depending on the dictionary. Some put them first, some put them last. But then sometimes I'll have a note that something about the etymology of the word and what it used to mean. And so a dictionary can be useful in that regard. Look at Mark 15:16. The soldiers took him away into the palace, that is the praetorium. So here we have into the palace, that is the praetorium, which I'm told by those who know the language, that's of Latin origin. So again, with the idea of the Latin reader, and that, and then the first century, that would have been Roman reader. In chapter 15, verse 15, wishing to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas for them, and after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. So here in the verse 15, in the American Standard Version, instead of to satisfy the multitude, it says to content the multitude. And again, we see that that is, from those who know Latin, that was really a Latin idiom, to satisfy the multitude. Okay, and then look at verse 15 of Matthew, Mark 15. Is that the one I want? I want the one that says scourge. Do I have the wrong verse?
No, that's right.
There it is. Scourged. All right. It must be the problem with this light, surely. Okay. Scourged. That's the one I wanted. And here we have it's a word, I don't know how to pronounce it, F-L-A-G-E-L-A-R-E, but evidently refers to the kind of instrument they used in this. I wouldn't know what that is if you put that word in English letters. So our translators take this Latin term that they would know what that is. To us, the word scourging connotes that idea. All right, and then Mark 15:39, the word centurion. We've done enough of that. Let's go to number 4.
Steve?
Yes, sir.
It seems like you have several internal evidences that's a Roman audience. It seems like this one's the strongest one.
Yeah, the Latinisms, I agree with you, seem like to be the strongest indication. I agree with you. When I used to read about these guys would say, like say in a Haley's Bible Handbook or something like that, they'd say, well, Matthew's for this reader and Luke for this reader and Mark's for this reader. And I said, where are they getting that? They didn't explain it. So I wanted to find out for myself if there was evidence for that or if they read it from somebody else who just dreamed it up. But here at number 4, absence of those things that point to a Jewish focus like in Matthew's Gospel. Now, that doesn't mean that, as you see on your lesson, does not indicate any special class of non-Jewish reader. Now, that doesn't necessarily point to a Roman reader, but it does point to something other than a Jewish reader, the very absence of the thing that Jews would look for. which you have in Matthew. And we discussed that in our last lesson. So as Rocky pointed out, this would not be as conclusive a point for a Roman reader, but it would point to the idea that it's not a Jewish reader that he was focusing on. Then you have this term Rufus, Mark 15:21. This one's based on a conjecture. Look at Romans 16:13. And sometimes you're going to read stuff that's what it's based on, is a conjecture. Paul's writing to the brethren in Rome, and he says, "Greet Rufus, a choice man in the Lord." So it's assumed sometimes that this Rufus is that Rufus that we read about in Mark. And if so, he was a Roman, and thus Mark has in mind the Roman reader who would know who Rufus is. So I could put a lot of weight on that, but it's an interesting thing to observe. Here's a real interesting thing about the Gospel of Mark. So here's Rome. It's a powerful empire. They had a great army. They marched fast. That's one of the reasons they conquered. They paved these roads. And they were a nation of action and power. Conquered so many people and nations around them. In Mark's Gospel, one of the things that is very prominent, now whether or not this is an appeal to that, I don't know. But it is something different about Mark. So open to Mark chapter 1. And you might want to, sometime when you're at home, want to mark this in some color, underline it or something so that you'll note it when you go through here. But we'll just take a real quick note at it, Mark chapter 1, how often this occurs. Mark 1:10, so talking about Jesus coming to be baptized by John, verse 9, immediately coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens open. Okay, good enough. He's baptized immediately, he saw the heavens open. But then after the voice is mentioned in verse 11, verse 12, immediately the Spirit implied him to go out into the wilderness. Now, you don't have those kind of statements in Matthew and Mark over and over again. So that's verse 12. Now you get down to verse 17. Jesus tells these men to be his disciples. He'd make them fishers of men. Then verse 18, immediately they left their nets. Now that's interesting if it is a time factor, because there was no hesitation on these men to leave their jobs right behind them and take off and follow Jesus. But after that, verse 20, immediately he called them. And they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and went away to follow him. Verse 21, you have it again. It's just repeated over and again. Then he went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath. So is this really just time markers, or is this a way of speaking? Something that would catch the reader who spoke that way and thought that way. I can't be certain about it, but it's a very interesting characteristic of Mark. Look at verse 28. Immediately the news about him was spread everywhere. Verse 29. Immediately after they came out of the synagogue, they came into the house of Simon and Andrew. Verse 30. Immediately they spoke to Jesus about her. Drop down to verse 42. Immediately the leprosy left him. Verse 43. He sternly warned him and immediately sent him away. That's just chapter 1. And so we have on your lesson all these other verses. I know you're hoping I don't go through all the rest of these verses. And you are so fortunate that I'm not. But you, when you have time, if you're interested in that, you can go through Mark and see this very, very strong emphasis on action. Immediate. Getting something done. And that would certainly be in accord with the nature of the empire of Rome. Here's another indication of emphasis on power, not just action immediately, quick action, but the idea of power. We have this point B. In Mark, there's 18 miracles recorded, but only 5 parables. Well, again, you say, so what? Well, there's the miracles. We're not going to read them all. But what you want to do is compare. Look at Matthew. You say, well, Matthew has 19 miracles. Well, that's right. But if you look down at the bottom of this comparison, we say Matthew, Mark is 63% as large as Matthew. So it's quite smaller, nearly 40% smaller, but it has 18 miracles. Whereas Matthew only has 19 miracles, being nearly 40% larger, showing Mark's emphasis on miracles. The same thing is true with Luke. Luke has 20 miracles, but Mark is only 59% of Luke, size-wise. Again, you would expect if it was proportionate that Mark would have quite a few more, or less, actually. And so then you have John only has 8 miracles. So this is really a mark of, that distinguishes the Gospel of Mark. It's immediacy, immediate, and the emphasis on Jesus' power in the working of miracles. Now, I've got a section here, part C, Jesus' words. I'm not going to read that paragraph. I'm going to let you read it. You probably, if you've done the lesson, you've already read it. So, it's another indication of the nature of Mark's gospel. You can read that in your own time. If you have any comments or questions about it, you can write me about it. But it further shows in his brevity and recording Jesus' words, it's a gospel of action and brevity. It's part D. It's the same thing. I'm not going to read that whole section. Well, I will. I think we've got time to read this one. The Roman Empire was represented in prophecy as one of strength and dominion. You can read that in Daniel 2:40. In that image that Daniel saw, it was the part that represented Rome was the idea of strength and dominion. Same thing in chapter 7, verse 7, 19, and 23 in those visions that Daniel had. Some have suggested Mark's style is peculiarly Roman and fits the idea of a soldier, and that it bears close resemblance to Caesar's commentaries in its rapidity of movement and dramatic effect. I'm not a student of Caesar's. Maybe you are. You could say yes or no, but that's somebody that knows both type writings. So whether Mark is written for Romans or not, we may not be able to be certain, but his style would fit an audience born and bred in an atmosphere of rule, power, and action. It would point the reader to a higher power and confirm the Christian faith in his faith in the power of Christ. So here the Holy Spirit wants to reach all men. He wants to reach Jews. Here's Matthew. But he wants to reach the guy who's not a Jew. Romans. And here Mark very possibly had the Roman reader, certainly Gentile readers, but maybe especially the Roman reader, try to capture even these people who were pagans and addicted to power and armies and conquering about the greatest king that ever was and his victory over sin and death. So I have this concluding paragraph, the internal evidence would harmonize with the focus on the Roman reader. Personally, I don't think it's conclusive. You can't be certain. I think Matthew, the evidence is so strong. But I think there's some evidence here that favors that. And maybe that will at least help if you're preparing to teach Mark and you read a commentary or some comments somewhere. You say, oh yeah, I think I remember where they got that, if you still have the lesson. More importantly is the last part of this lesson. Whether Mark especially had the Roman reader in view or not, it is clear, two things are clear. One, what he intended to record, and number two, why. So how did he start his gospel? Do you remember? The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. The Son of God. That's how he began the gospel. Now he's at the very end. What's he going to choose to close this gospel? So Jesus is with the men who are going to be given the charge to carry this gospel out to people. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to the whole creation. Why? Who cares about this history in the first century? Maybe the people of that time. No, he says, you preach it to anybody and everybody. Here's why. He who has believed. What? This gospel you preach that I just wrote about, divided into 16 chapters in our Bibles. They didn't have the chapter divisions, of course. You go preach that gospel. He who believes that gospel that Mark wrote, and that faith promotes that person, induces that person, motivates that person to be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ. He who believes and is baptized, you know what's going to happen? Roman, Jew, Gentile, makes no difference. Man, woman, makes no difference. He'll be saved. That's why Mark wrote the gospel. How important is believing this gospel? Read the last phrase of verse 16. What happens to the person who doesn't believe it? I don't believe that stuff. He's going to be condemned. The day of judgment. That's how important it is. You know, some of you are now doing your daily Bible reading for the new year. How important is it that we read the Bible? How important is we nurture our faith in what we read? The difference is eternity. You believe it and act on it, you can be saved through the person that it exalts, Jesus Christ. You don't believe it, it doesn't cause a change in your life. It doesn't affect how you live day to day, how you treat your mate, your neighbor, your children, your parents. You'll be condemned in judgment. That's how important these books are. And that's really what Mark was wanting to accomplish in the writing of the Gospel of Mark. Okay, the next class, if the Lord is willing, we'll look at the Gospel of Luke. I don't know if we can do it in one lesson or not, but we did get through Mark, and so we're going to tackle Luke in our next lesson, and some pretty interesting things that we'll look at in the Gospel of Luke. Thank you for your attention.